giant robot smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. My name is Ben Orenstein, and I'm here today with Max Temkin. How's it going, Max?
Pretty good.
Awesome.
I'm so excited to do this podcast that's about to start now.
It absolutely is about to start.
It hasn't already happened.
It's definitely, we did not record this at the end of the podcast and then slice it into the beginning. So I thought it would be funny to do this whole interview with you and not mention Cards Against Humanity at all.
Let's do it. I'm into it.
I mean, I thought it'd be funny, but not practical.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You know? I mean, I did, as I'm researching you, I'm seeing that, you know, this is what you get asked about all the time. Like, are you sick of talking about this stuff?
No, it's super fun to talk about Cards Against Humanity, and it's really fun, and it's fun. In a way, it's like really, it's incredibly gratifying that people like the game, because the game was always like the weird, you know, nerdy inside jokes that me and my friends were like bullied for when we were younger. So now it's like, I can't tell you how gratifying it is to like go out to a bar and there's like a table of people at the bar playing this, you know, playing literally like our inside jokes that people would make fun of us for, you know, when we were, you know, on the playground or whatever. So
totally,
that's great. And I love talking about the game, but I will say that it's like, sometimes it can be frustrating. Like there, you know, the world of like independent games is so lively, and it's experiencing such a renaissance right now, and there's this really like beautiful art being made in that space, and it's occasionally frustrating to me that like Cards Against Humanity will get focus at the exclusion of some of the other cool stuff that's happening in like the indie game scene. But
I found myself wondering if like you felt almost a victim of your own success, where everyone wants to talk about this one thing, and like you're doing other stuff too.
Yeah, it's hard not to. Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like Cards Against Humanity is too stupid for me to kind of do full time. So I try and keep like other, you know, plenty of other projects going at the same time. And also like, I'm confident that it's going to fail at any second, that it's just going to, everyone's going to get bored of it and that'll be it. Like every set we sell, I always am like, well, that was it. This good run while it lasted. Let's pack it up.
Right.
So you know, I like to have a lot of stuff on the back burner. It's a fun thing to talk about. Like I feel incredibly lucky that like connected with an audience and it means something to people. Like that's what anyone hopes for with their work. So that's very satisfying.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that you keep waiting for it to fail or stop. It's like, it feels like a little bit of imposter syndrome going on.
I would say that's accurate. Yeah, I think you can be very aware of imposter syndrome, and that it's a fallacy that, you know, a lot of creative people fall prey to, and that it's not really accurate, but for everyone except for yourself, because for yourself, it's totally real. Like literally at any moment in this podcast, everyone could actually discover that I'm a fraud and I'm faking it and that I don't know what I'm doing, and that Cards Against Humanity isn't that funny anyway, and that it's just the jokes are already all written there, and it's not that fun to play, and there's better games out there, and why are we buying this thing anyway?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
I give it until the end of the day.
Sure. Well, we won't publish this for a couple days, so you can sneak in a couple more things during the week.
Okay. Oh, good.
Before we all know that you're a fraud.
Okay.
It's
yeah. Wasn't that game fun while it lasted, man?
Yeah, it was okay.
Remember that thing? Yeah. Like Pet Rock. Got very popular all of a sudden, and then never heard from it again.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have some other games that you're working on right now that look really interesting.
Yeah, there's the first game I made that was sort of my intro to indie games, called Humans vs. Zombies, and that's like what's called a big game. So it's like, big games are usually characterized by being physical games that take place in the real world. So there's like running and jumping and you know, being played on playgrounds or college campuses or parks or things like that. And then they're usually played in public spaces. So like public parks, urban spaces, cities, places where there's spectators. So Humans versus Zombies is this huge game of tag where there's a team of zombies trying to tag all the humans and eat them, and a team of humans just trying to survive, and they can sort of stun the zombies with Nerf guns. So my friends and I started that in college, and we started it as just, much like Cards Against Humanity, it was just a thing that we wanted for ourselves. Like it was like, hey, this is what we like doing in our free time. Let's create like a really nicely organized version of this game. And as we started playing it, people saw us playing and they saw us having fun and they wanted to join in. And then by the time we graduated, the games were had, you know, almost half the school was playing at our, you know, I went to a very small school, but half of the students were playing. The games would go for like a week. They would be these huge things that would happen every semester.
Wow.
And then the game started spreading to other schools. So now the game is played at about 750 colleges and universities. And then we help organize each of those games for free. The company is a sort of a nonprofit model, not necessarily voluntarily. That's just sort of how it shook out for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then way more recently, like in the last month, I published this video game, the first video game I worked on, called Samurai Gun. That's a 4-player local multiplayer game for PC, and then soon it's coming to some consoles.
Mm. It's interesting to me when I hear you talk about your games and indie games in general. It sounds a little bit like open source software. Like Card started off with this free thing. Like here are the components, you can build it yourself. Maybe it still is like that, and you guys sort of just provide one implementation if you're interested. There seems to be a lot of parallels there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, games are. There definitely are a lot of parallels there in terms of the values, right? Like, I want these ideas to be free. I think if people want these games badly enough, they'll pirate them anyway. You know, they'll post the, you know, even if we tried to somehow sell Humans versus Zombies, like someone would just post the, they just make a paste bin with the rules, right? Like, it's not that hard to like steal the idea of the games. I mean, I don't know if the video is going to be saved anywhere, but I'm making air quotes around the idea of the
no,
game.
No, just audio.
Okay, well, hopefully everyone heard my air quotes, but you know, there's nothing so precious about those ideas. So it's you know, and the same for Cards. So it's always made sense to us to make it available for free. And from a more like strategic point of view, and this is where I think the indie games are a little different than software. You know, games are a consumer product. Like individual people are need to make a decision to buy them and to play them. You know, software, especially open source software, tends to be like something that a developer will use as a tool, right? So it's a slightly different way of marketing it. But you know, for a game to be successful, a lot of people need to hear about it, and they need to have an incentive to sort of tell their friends about it. So making it free has been this amazing shortcut we've discovered to just getting people really excited about a game and feeling like they have some ownership of it, and feeling like they received a gift from us, and they want to then they feel good about sharing the game and promoting it and telling people about it. It's you know, it wasn't like wasn't necessarily so strategic that we like planned it that way, but it's been a nice effect that we've discovered of making stuff free, and definitely something I plan to continue doing with future projects.
Mm. You don't seem, reading interviews from you and hearing you say things like that, you don't seem to be particularly motivated by money.
Well, I have, you know, especially like, you know, during college and after college, I was doing freelance design. I was just working as a graphic designer, and I had no money, and I cared a lot more about money at that point. Like, it was, you know, whether I got paid by a client or not would affect like if I could buy groceries or not, or if I had to like go crawling back to my parents and beg for money for rent or something. Mm. So that, I mean, it's in a certain sense, like not caring about money is a form of privilege of people who can afford to say that, you know, already have money. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I have had enough of these, you know, Humans versus Zombies and Cards and some of my other side projects have been successful. And I have found that the less that if I can go into a project and not, well, in some senses, not care about the money, it makes the project more healthy, and it helps me discover the like underlying values and principles of an idea that are going to get people excited about it, versus thinking of it in a more selfish way of like, how do I make the most out of this? The reason I say that's only in some places is I do think projects, you know, I try to only work on things that really matter to me and I have some like emotional investment in, and I think that they'll matter to other people and people will find some sort of meaning in it. And I think in those instances, you have a special responsibility to make projects sustainable. So you can't, you know, I think it's just like it is irresponsible and in a sense, you know, it's maybe a little greedy to go into a project and just be like, what can I get out of this for myself? Like, how do I make the best return out of it? How do I get the most money out of it? It can be similarly like short-sighted and greedy to just say, well, I'm going to make this thing and it's going to be really unsustainable, or I'm going to take like investment money for this thing that never has a chance of making money and build this thing that people are going to rely on and care about, and then sort of secretly know that it never has a chance of lasting on its own on its own merits. So I think that building sustainably, there's a value to that too. So I think that you do have to hit that right balance of finding ways for your ideas to last and continue to help people, and also to, you know, as part of that idea, doing service to people, you know, not being so selfish about it that you take everything of value out of it for yourself. You have to leave something there for users and players and the people experiencing it.
Mm. Can you take us through an average day for you?
Sure. I don't know. I mean, I don't even have an average day anymore. Like, it's just chaos, but, you know, most days, like I'm usually up around, 8 or 9. In college, I started meditating. Like there was this like meditation club at college. And I found that it really helped me with like anxiety and it mm. just, I don't know, it just helped me, it helped me just be, put me in a mind frame of like being very grateful for what I have and not panicking. You know, sometimes, I don't know if you ever get this, but sometimes you just like wake up and you start panicking about whatever dumb thing is the first thing you think of. And it's a really important way to just sort of sit and clear your head and take some control over what you're going to care about that day and what you're going to think about. So that's a really important part of my kind of daily routine. So I usually sit for, you know, 10, 20 minutes and just do that sort of like Zazen meditation, it's called, where you're just, you're not trying to like do anything. You're just trying to sort of sit there and be aware of yourself sitting there and then not have any thoughts, which it's not possible. You're just supposed to sort of recognize, okay, I'm thinking about this. I'm obsessing about this thing, or I'm having anxiety about this thing, and then just sort of let it go. And that, I find that to be, something that's definitely, helpful to me and really sets the tone for my day. So like on days when I skip that, I'm more of a mess.
So you're pretty, you're pretty regular with that?
Yeah, pretty much every day since college.
That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, and there's been a lot written about that too, of like from a more, you know, a scientific standpoint, that's pretty cool. I'd also recommend, like, if people are interested in learning more about meditation, two cool resources. One is a book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. That was sort of the book that got me into it. And I just found that to be like a good refreshing. It's, you know, it's not really like bullshitty. It's just a very practical guide to like how to start getting into this. And also a podcast I really like called Back to Work with Merlin Mann. They did an episode recently called Anxiety's a Goat. And it was just about anxiety and how actually both of the hosts of that podcast have gotten into meditation and found it helpful with their anxiety too. And this is now becoming a really rambling answer, but that episode of Back to Work also made a great connection for me between anxiety and procrastination. And I'm a chronic procrastinator, and I'm also an anxious person. And, you know, of course it's obvious now that I think about it, that like, you know, procrastination is being anxious to start something because you're scared that it's going to fail or you're going to screw it up. So, I think that's probably another thing that I can say about meditation, is it gives me a little less fear of just like jumping into something getting started with something that I need to do. And then the rest of my day, we started an office in Chicago for Cards Against Humanity, and it's also a co-working space. So we have all kinds of writers and photographers and designers and game designers and journalists who share desks in the office with us. So, you know, I usually head in to work around 10 or 11, and then we'll do a morning check-in meeting with all the Cards employees. We have four employees who work with us on, you know, customer service stuff and planning events, and I hired a junior designer. So usually we work off of Basecamp, so we'll just sort of like sit down, do our morning check-in, open up Basecamp, like go through all our projects, like, what do people need anything from me? Are they blocking on anything? You know, do people have any questions? And then everyone just sort of like goes about their day, and there's a good amount of just screwing around. Like, we play a lot of Spelunky and other video games in the office, usually like order lunch together or sometimes go out. And then we'll do a checkout meeting at 5 o'clock and just sort of go over, you know, here, what do we do over the day? What did we accomplish? Like, are there any problems? That kind of a thing. And then everyone takes off, and occasionally I will do more meetings and stuff at night, or just have, go meet people to play board games, or, it really depends on what's going on at that point of the year. And then also, like, increasingly, we're just traveling so much for Cards Against Humanity and for some of my other projects. Like, and I'm doing some speaking and stuff. So, you know, pretty much almost every month this year, like, I'm taking some sort of trip and getting to go to all these cool things. So, I kind of like that. Like, the more I've been, like, come to terms with, like, not having any schedule or routine and just sort of, like, just this chaos of, like, you know, come in at a different hour every day and get a different amount of work done every day and travel all the time. Like, I kind of like it. Like, I have a lot of fear of, like, falling into a routine and getting comfortable. You know, I want to be on my toes. I think that's a healthy way to, like, approach creative projects is to try not to fall into any, like, assumptions about it. So I find that really helpful of just sort of switching things up periodically. Like, you know, you get comfortable and then, like, you know, boom, you got to go on a trip or something and it's going to shake things up. Mm. This is a great, do you know, the show with Zay Frank, do you remember that?
Yep.
Kind of an older, yeah. So he did, in the original run of the show, he did this video called the Bust Your Cycle. And it was just about, like, you know, every once in a while, just, like, have a weird day, just, like, do the opposite of what you do every day, you know, go out and go for a walk instead of going to work or something. And the idea is just, like, bust your cycle, like, get out of your way of looking at the world and your way of thinking about things. And it helps you sort of feel some sense of control over your life. And, you know, seeing the habits and assumptions that you make about your life and sort of exposing them. So that's something I've definitely tried to keep in mind. And another thing, a weird thing that I took away from that too, is, like, I try to move apartments every year. Hmm. So that's another way of trying to not fall into, like, a daily routine. So I like that because it helps me find, like, learn about new neighborhoods in Chicago. And you know, I learn the city really well that way. It also prevents me from owning too many things. Like, if you move every year, you have a strong incentive not to buy things because everything you buy, you're like, I'm gonna have to move that in a year.
Hmm.
So I found that to be another really helpful thing in terms of not sort of falling into bad habits.
Yeah. What's your concern around having a lot of routine or a lot of things?
Well, I mean, I guess I feel like what I value in projects and ideas is a sense of novelty, of, like, question of not being part of the status quo, being something that's different or you know, outsider. You know, I highly value novelty in the stuff that I work on, and I want to, you know, even if I'm doing something that's, you know, a remix or a twist on something, like, I want the twist to be strong and good. So I think it's, like, just preventing yourself from falling into that routine. Like, I never want to have a point in my life where I like wake up in the morning and go, like, man, what have I been doing for the last 6 months? Like, I haven't challenged myself or done anything exciting or been scared of anything. I don't know. I feel like that somehow, for me at least, that's related to doing good work. It may also be partially related to, like, the procrastination thing. You know, if I'm getting to a place where I'm really comfortable, like, man, I can find endless reasons not to do what I'm supposed to do. Like, I can just procrastinate to the point of nothing ever getting done. So I like to, you know, when the spirit strikes, when the muse speaks to me and I actually have some desire to do some work, I want it to be very low friction. Like, I want to have a flexible schedule so I can clear, you know, it's like, man, I want to work on this thing right now. I want to have some ability to, like, set aside time and do it right then and stay up all night if I want to, or, you know, wake up early if I want to, you know, I want to have that flexibility. I do well in a last minute panic. I find that very motivating. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So you've started doing some Kickstarter consulting.
I don't know if I'd call it consulting, but I did this thing for a couple of months called Kickstarter Office Hours, where I just did a Google Plus Hangout with anyone who was kind of doing a new creative project and they wanted to talk to someone about it. And it was just like a Google Plus chat, and we talked about their idea, and they would tell me what they were scared of, or maybe there were specific things of, like, how do you print playing cards or whatever. And then just any way that I could or I could offer advice or whatever, I would talk to people. And I did that. So I did about, I think I did 3 months of that. And I did a little over 50 meetings in those 3 months. So it was 2 hours every Tuesday and Thursday.
Hmm.
And I ultimately, I committed to doing those 3 months and I did them. And then I didn't continue it because I felt like it wasn't scaling very well. Like the more meetings I did, the more people wanted to have meetings. And then I found myself just repeating myself every time of giving, you know, I mean, obviously, like I'm one person. I have one, I'm going to have one strong perspective on this. So that's going to be natural, right? Of like, I'm going to be giving my opinion to people over and over.
Yeah.
But right now I'm trying to find some way to, using that same amount of time, is there a way that I can give advice that more people can use? Can I reach more people and make this stuff more available? Because I think it started to feel like it felt weird because like what I love about Kickstarter and the reason I want to help people do their projects, I love that there's no gatekeepers to it, right? It's like you can do some weird outsider idea that should never work. And if enough people say, I like this, it's going to happen, right? Like it's such an inversion of like the power structures that used to keep that stuff from getting made.
Mm.
And it's so empowering for people. And then I just had this real fear of like, so many people were trying to do these like Kickstarter office hours with me. I had this feeling of like becoming a gatekeeper myself, of like, there was some sort of like, you had to like go on top of the mountain and like get advice from someone who will do Kickstarter office hours. You know, I don't want to contribute to that culture.
Yeah.
Because the fact is you don't need advice. Like I have never known what I've been doing. I just faked it and put a project up and hoped that it would work out and, you know, tried to use the resources I had to make the best decisions. And if you, you know, if you're the right person to do a project and you believe in it, generally, I think that will shake out. But I want to find some way where I can make it, you know, the process of giving and getting advice on these things a little more democratic. And, you know, I don't want it to be another system of like gatekeeping. I want anyone to feel like they have access to that.
So you're starting a Kickstarter for Kickstarter advice?
Yeah. I don't know. That has been done, by the way. There are many guides to Kickstarter that have been Kickstarted successfully and unsuccessfully. It's always funny when someone wants to write a book about Kickstarter and they put it on about how to use Kickstarter and they put it on Kickstarter and their project fails.
Yeah.
That has happened and it's always pretty funny.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Let me ask your thoughts on this. I was thinking of maybe doing a podcast about it. So like I would still have those one-to-one meetings with people, but then they would be recorded and people could listen to it and then they would hear those same, you know, at least they would have access to the conversation.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Oh, don't start a podcast. It's miserable.
Is it, I guess my fear about that format is like, is advice that I give to one person for their project, or if it's not me, right, there could be a variety of different people giving advice on this thing, but is advice that's for one project, is that really like, can you really like universalize that advice to any project?
I mean, I think you'd be the best person to answer that, but just judging on what you've said so far, you said you were repeating yourself a lot in office hours. So it sounds like there's some kernels there that are repeatable.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, there's some things I really strongly believe about Kickstarter. Like I really believe, I think simple projects are great. Like, I don't know if you ever go on a Kickstarter project and some people will do these like huge projects with like 500 rewards. And it's like, you can get the platinum level, which comes with these bundles and not this bundle. I'm like, you're losing people's attention there. Like, you know, there are people who go to this, who want to support you and then they're leaving because there is too much crap on the page, just like anything, right? That's just design. That's not even Kickstarter advice at that point. That's just like good design principles of like have the minimum possible amount of things there so that people can pay attention to them all.
You know, yeah. You know what I like about the podcast idea for this is that if my initial thought when you were saying I found myself repeating myself a lot was, okay, well, you should probably distill the common parts and put it in a book. But then you end up with, so that I think there that still might be okay, but you end up with the most generic advice in the book.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have a podcast with a number of guests and someone listens to a half a dozen of them, they'll hear the parts that you repeat and sort of take those as the generic things. But they also get to hear the custom advice you give for particular situations, which is likely to be, you know, less widely applicable. But, you know, they might hear this one thing that for their product is perfect and, you know, means the world to them to hear.
Yeah, that's exactly what I once I started thinking about doing a podcast that I really liked about it, of like there will still be some of that to the extent that you can generalize advice about starting any new creative project, like that advice will be there. And I think it could be cool to get like, you know, co-hosts and interesting creative people to come and give advice, you know, on that podcast as well. Yeah, but then people will, you know, it's more of like, it's more valuable, I think, to be like, well, how do you think about this? Not like, how do I solve this problem for my specific project? But like, if I have this thing I want to make, how do I find what's essential about it and explain it to other people? Like, that's kind of its own skill set.
Totally. And it, I think it'll be useful to hear, for people to hear your approach to understanding the idea and you sort of like walking through different elements of it. So like, I really believe in the power of seeing people's process. Because if you did just a book, for example, that's like, this is the finished work. This is the thing. These are the things I've decided are most generally applicable. And they're presented as still life at the end, as opposed to like listening to you kind of explore the person's idea and kind of push back and forth and figure some things out. There's so much information in that. It's so high bandwidth that I think you can teach a lot more when people can see the process.
Yeah, I think that's that's a really good point. Yeah, man, I should really figure out how to do a podcast, huh?
It's not so bad. It's pretty easy.
Cool.
And sometimes cool people will respond to your invitations to be on and you get to chat with them.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
Like it was
I've been listening to, you've had some really cool guests on this. I've been really getting into the backlog in the last few weeks. It's great.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean I'm continually amazed at the people that say yes. I'm like, "Why are you on the pod?" Like, I mean, I'm totally glad and totally flattered, but it's funny how often you can just email someone and be like, "Hey, we want to talk to you because we think you're cool." And they're like, "Yeah, sure. When?" It's great. It's been shocking.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you're like, "Hey, I'm Max. I want to talk to you about stuff," they'd be like, "Yeah, totally."
Or you know, maybe like, would you do an interview of like, you know, get interesting project creators on Kickstarter and be like, would you want to do an interview of like how you thought about your project and how did you build it to help people sort of learn about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I say do it. Go for it.
Cool.
But don't start a Kickstarter for it.
Yeah. Right. Well, nice thing about a podcast is I think it's pretty low. I mean, like if you have a microphone, like I think it's pretty low cost.
Totally.
And there's some really good solutions. I think I'll probably hit you up with some podcast advice at some point. But I think there's some pretty. It's gotten like technically a little easier.
Yep. Yeah.
To like distribute this stuff.
So. Yeah. Totally. I'm happy to offer some thoughts.
Cool.
So I've researched you a bunch. I see that you've done a good amount of interviews. You seem pretty willing to talk to people. I saw someone ask you, what question do you wish you weren't asked anymore? And which I think was, you said, I wish people stopped asking how much money Cards has made. So I want to flip that around on you and say, what do you wish you were asked? What don't you get to talk about enough?
I would love to talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine and which are the good episodes and which are the bad episodes and why Sisko is the best captain and, the whole plot arc of the series. That's what I never get asked about. I can't believe no one ever wants to talk about
it. Yeah. Well, as soon as you start your own podcast, I think you can cover that in complete depth and detail.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I mean, I think to me, the stuff I'm always the most interested in, I'm interested in like, I love hearing about people's projects and about the things they make and all that. But I'm like, I'm way more interested in like how they conceptualize like problems that they're trying to solve and what their worldview is and like, well, what made you see the world in terms of like thinking about this problem and coming up with the solution to it. Like that's way more interesting to me. And that maybe that's like the philosophy major in me, that, you know, wants to understand like more like, you know, the principles behind this stuff. But that's always what I'm interested in. And I always think it's a bummer when there's like, you know, when I'm listening to a podcast with a cool guest and then they'll never really ask, you know, like very penetrating questions about like, well, you know, what were the thought processes that like informed these decisions? And, you know, that like, this was like, did you read that, the Steve Jobs bio, the Walter Isaacson, like Steve Jobs biography?
I'm working on it.
It's like, I hated that book, because, the main issue to me was like, it was a good story of the guy's life. And it really did it. You know, I think what it set out to do was humanize him and show that what a flawed guy he was and really make you see him as a person. And it did do that. But, you know, I'm sort of not interested in all the times that Steve Jobs was an asshole to people. Like, I know a lot of assholes, but not all of them made the Mac. So like, I want to know, what was it about Steve Jobs that was like in his character or the way that he thought about the world that made him him? And I just didn't think that book even tried to answer that question. So it was sort of frustrating to me. So that's That's the stuff that I always wish people would talk about more. And I always think that, like, in trying to figure out that stuff in my work, like I always understand what I'm doing more. So I think it's a helpful process to go through for people too.
Mm. So what makes you you then?
I guess for the main like the big ideas behind the games that I've worked on. So in Humans versus Zombies, the big game of tag, the first thing we found was, like, when we started playing with it, how much it just sort of, like, subsumed your entire life into this game. Like, everything just became the game, right? So, and what was kind of cool about that was, like, so you're in college. It's supposed to be the most fun time of your life. And you just find yourself in the same sort of, like, bullshit routine of, like, you know, you wake up and you go to the cafeteria and you go to class and you come home and you do your homework and you go to sleep. And Humans versus Zombies, you're doing the same thing. Like, you're eating the same crappy food and you're going to class and you're doing the same things every day. But suddenly it was like this epic adventure and you were fighting for your life. So you had, you were being chased and trying to survive and cut through the woods to take a shortcut. And that was like, I think that was just so empowering because you saw in playing the game how much of your day-to-day experience, it wasn't your experience, it was you. It was what you brought to it, and it was the way that you approached it. And it was the rules, the sort of unspoken rules of, like, how you're supposed to act and what's important to you and what you care about that make an experience meaningful or not. So that was really cool. And that sort of realization, that's what I've been, like, chasing after in all of the games and yeah. interesting, you know, projects and stuff I've done since. Is that sort of sense of empowerment and pointing out these sort of hidden social rules and, you know, pushing on them and making people aware of them and trying to make people feel more empowered in their own experiences and their own lives.
Mm.
And there's also something really political about that. This probably also speaks to my background in politics, but, there's this great games philosopher, Bernie DeKoven, and he has this great quote of, he's written a lot about big games and about playing in public. And he says that playing games in public is inherently political because when you play a game in public, you're showing people a new way to behave that is not the normal way to behave. And that freaks people out, right? People acting according to rules that aren't the normal social rules. That's political. That is subversive. It's radical. And especially for a game where you're acting in a way that is not motivated by fear or selfishness, but you're playing with people in this really, you know, intimate, loving way, and you're creating this reality with people where it doesn't matter, you know, what gender or sex you are, it doesn't matter what race you are, your how much money you have, you know, all those things get set aside in the face of, like, being chased by a zombie. That is a radical political vision, and it's showing people that those are not rules that are inherent to people; they're just rules inherent to the particular way that we organize our lives and the way that we act, and that we could just as easily organize our lives another way and act another way. So that's sort of the political payoff of all of this for me. And if there's ways for something like a game to point at that, then it's a worthwhile project. Like, it's not quite as trivial to spend your time making a game. I think that's definitely an idea in Cards Against Humanity too. I mean, we have Cards Against Humanity is all about taking these really powerful, shocking things or upsetting things or taboo things, and then not only, like, saying them out loud and talking about them, but laughing at them. So it's sort of, the idea is giving you some power over them and taking away some of the power of those words and ideas. And it's also a way for us to sort of, there's this great George Carlin quote that when people laugh, their minds are open up to a new idea for, like, just a second.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also a big idea in Cards Against Humanity of, like, if you can get people laughing, especially at these big ideas and these big concepts and, like, these big societal taboos, you know, we can make jokes about our audience, right? So we make jokes about privilege and white privilege and heteronormativity and all of the ways that the people who buy and play our game are flawed, right? So it's identifying, like, power structures and laughing at them and making fun of them, and in some cases giving people a vocabulary to talk about them and laugh at them. Hmm. That's kind of the subversive and cool political thing that I like about Cards Against Humanity that makes it fun for me to work on. And that's also present in, like, I think we also, like, we're good at at touching that with the way that we talk about the game and market it and promote it. Mm-hmm. So like a great example is like our Black Friday sale for this year.
Yeah.
We did this dumb thing where we, instead of lowering our prices for Black Friday, we did an everything is $5 more sale. It was like one of our best day of sales ever. Like people loved it. And it just was honest, right? It spoke to what people like about our game, which is sort of like, we identified this, like this absurdity in the culture of like Black Friday. Black Friday is the dumbest. I mean, I don't even think we need to get into it. It's just this incredibly annoying and stupid trend. And we found a way to subvert it in a way that was just felt right to us. Like it felt honest to us to not care if we sold any games that day and just be like, well, fuck it. We'll just do something funny on Black Friday.
Yeah.
And people responded to it. Like it was fun. It was cool. Like it was a fun, that was one of my favorite things we've been able to do with cards so far.
Yeah. It was very consistent with your DNA. It seems too. It's like, if it's funny, we don't care if it costs us money. Let's do it anyway.
Yeah. And also like every time we've made that gamble, it's worked for us. Like mm-hmm. it actually wound up being great. Like so many people, because we did that thing, they wound up like hearing about the game
right
in that context, which is great.
Yep. So I keep hearing you mention things like, you move apartments every year, you pick up new projects, you like new ways to fund projects, you know, a new way to walk to class to avoid zombies.
Yeah.
Are you a novelty addict? Does that worry you at all? Is there dysfunction in there, or is that all cool?
You know, it's not the novelty that appeals to me, because there are other places culturally where there's like an obsession with novelty that just grates on me. So like Twitter is one example of like, man, Twitter is just always looking for like the new thing to care about, where it's like, we're going to really hate this person for like 6 hours and then completely forget that they exist. And that bugs me. Like I don't do well on that sort of a thing where it's like, or, you know, on Reddit where it's just like, what is the new head just churn of like new headlines every day. So in that sense, like novelty as just trivia that sort of, it's this like unending barrage of just trivial garbage. Like that really stresses me out. But what I like about that idea of like busting your cycle and moving and starting new projects and stuff, like I just don't want to be comfortable. I want to have that sort of liquidity in my life and that kind of taking a risk with my life, so that if I have a new idea or I do a new thing, it's really hard to come up with an excuse, right? It's like, oh, I can't do it because, you know, I have these factors in my life which prevent me from doing it. Just don't have those factors in your life, right? Like stay on your toes. And then it's like, if I have to travel for this thing, or I have to, you know, buy some, you know, it's like, oh, I want to, get into screen printing or whatever, like, you know, being, having a lot of like liquidity and being able to like move to an apartment where I have room to get an exposure unit to start doing screen printing is cool. Like it opens up all these possibilities. So I feel like it's like, in some senses, it's just not sabotaging yourself so that you can do the ideas that you think of.
Do you feel happy?
I feel satisfied, and I feel grateful, and I feel lucky. I don't know that I feel happy, but I'm not really like a happy person by disposition. Like I kind of can't help but looking at the world and seeing the ways that it's unfair or cruel or boring or trivial. And I don't know, maybe that's, the more people I meet who are doing, you know, interesting creative stuff, like that just, they're weird people and they don't fit in. And that's part of what's part of their creative voice. So I've stopped trying to obsess over my own personal happiness as much. And I think it's made me more content, right? Like I don't necessarily worry. And it's tough too, because you go to conferences or you see talks, and that's all people talk about is like, follow your bliss and do what makes you happy. And if you're not happy, stop doing this thing. I've never been happy doing, you know, I worked on the Obama campaign in 2008, and that's probably the most romantic, like meaningful, important thing I've ever done in my life. It was miserable. It sucked. I was sleeping 4 hours a night, and I was working all the time, and I was terrified of screwing it up, and I was in way over my head, and I had a shitty job, and I wasn't getting paid. I mean, everything was wrong with it. I was miserable. I was living with my parents. Like, everything sucked. But it was, I look back on it and it was one of the best things I've ever done with my life. So I just don't know that one's own personal happiness is the best barometer for like, if you're doing the most important thing or the most satisfying thing or the most worthwhile thing with your time.
Awesome. I think that's a great place to leave it.
Cool.
So I think that wraps things up. Thanks very much for stopping by, Max. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
Totally. So if you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to thoughtbot.com/giantrobots/85. Thanks for listening.